Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, January 20th, 2016. The time is 1:30. Members present are Representative Wilson, Guerra, Pruitt, Kawasaki, Vice Chair Sadler, Co-Chair Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Newman. We have Representative Guttenberg, Gaddis. I expect Representative Munoz and Edgman shortly. In the audience, we do have Senator Kelly. And Josephson, Representative Josephson Ortiz, and Representative Kathy Tilton. I think that's all we see currently. Hopefully we'll have some more later. Today we have a House, the agenda is David Teal, Legislative Finance Analyst for Legislative Finance Division. Going to go through an overview of the FY17 budget. I did talk to Mr. Teal earlier. So what we want to try and do is we'll work through questions as we go along. It's kind of an important issue we're talking about. If we need him to come back later, I guess we'll have to do that. But with that, Mr. Teal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good to be back again. If you don't mind, I've got some staff here, and I'd like them to stand up and introduce themselves.
Please.
There are a couple more, but it's a guy thing. They didn't, you know. They didn't check. So,
give them a shout out sometime. Go ahead.
And I'm David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance. You've all seen this chart before. It's, I think, the best introduction to a budget that I can think of, and that's because by giving you a 40-year history of state spending and revenue, it just lends some perspective to the 17 budget. So for those who haven't seen the chart before, it shows revenue in the green background. Agency budgets are dark blue, and agency operating budgets are just the day-to-day operating budgets of the various state agencies. The light blue is statewide things, that's debt service, retirement assistance, and fund capitalizations, a few things that aren't associated with any particular department. The yellow is the capital, and then you have the red bars. If they're above the line, that means it's a surplus. If they're below the line, it's a deficit. So one of the takeaways from this chart is that spending is correlated with revenue, which is the economist way of saying that the budget was flat when we didn't have any money back here, and that when we do have money, we spend it. And I'm not going to look too much in the past, just try to get through this thing. What happened here was, in recent years, after 2005, really, we did get incredible increases in revenue. We also had increases in expenditures. And those increases in expenditures are not just capital, as you might expect when there's extra money, it goes to capital projects. The first thing that gets reduced when money gets tighter is the capital budget. The operating budget also increased fairly rapidly there. In fact, we went from a budget of about $2.5 billion, which was a pretty steady budget, up to $7.8 billion by 2013, which didn't seem so bad at the time because there were surpluses in every year despite the enormous increase in spending. But revenue began declining in FY13. We didn't know that, of course, in preparing the 13 budget. You don't know that until FY14. So the response to declining budget in FY13 was a smaller capital project. And I'm just going to switch to the next slide. It's a whole lot easier to see. So same thing, it's just condensed. Yeah.
David, if we can stay back on the prior slide. We've looked at this in the past, and when you've got these numbers, particularly agency operations, we'll just go to that one. I know that we've talked about this before, and I don't see it described here. Are these numbers adjusted for inflation so the value of a dollar is apples for apples?
Not yet. That's the next slide. So,
okay.
But as you know, you can compare 16 and 17 or 15 to 17 even without adjusting for inflation. But if you're going to look back 40 years and don't correct for inflation, they're not even comparable, because what cost $1 back then now costs $3. So if you don't adjust, it actually distorts your picture. So this is just from 13 on, so it makes it easier to see. As I said, the 14 budget revenue declined by $1.5 billion. What happened there was the 15 capital budget was reduced in response to lower revenue. Statewide continued to grow. In FY15, revenue really crashed. And the response to that was, in preparing the FY16 budget, capital became very low. And that was the first year of an operating budget cut, was last year. So now we get to FY17. It's another year of low projected revenue. And we see that operating budget is about $100 million lower. Statewide is higher, and the capital budget's gone up. The capital budget's up by about $75 million.
Yeah. Next question.
Okay.
So, and you can finish that, because I just have to do this slide. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on at least the last three, do you know how much the budget price per barrel, the budget was based on, and then what the actual price per barrel was, you know, once it became law?
Not off the top of my head. I mean, we through the chair, we have that information. I can get it for you. But I think, as you know, the budget was based on prices that were much higher than things turned out.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, Representative Wilson.
So the budget that we're starting to review, can you tell me what price per barrel the current governor budget that he's proposing is based on?
Through the chair, $56.
Thank you.
Mr. Teal, while we're here, if the budget was based on $56, we're at $30 now. The issue is, with only 500,000 barrels a day, what's the difference in value of income to the state between $30 and $50 oil?
I've got a slide on that too, but I'll just hold on that one until we get there.
So we have a few more questions. Representative Edgman, Gaddis, and Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted, David, get a sense of, we cut the budget last year, was it $400 million plus on the operating side and about the same amount on the capital side? But what's the actual reduction in state employees? And you maybe want to go back 2 years instead of 1 year, but I'm thinking of a presentation that Neil Fried made to a committee in Anchorage in early December, and his number was 1,400, but I wasn't sure if that was vacancies or if that was actual bodies or what that really was.
Okay. Through the chair, Pat Pitney gave a presentation in the Senate Finance Committee this morning and said that number was 600 actual full-time positions. That's people, not vacant positions.
And Representative Edgman, Pat Pitney, Director of OMB, will be here Friday and give us that information.
And just if I might, Mr.
Go ahead, Representative.
Just 600 in the last calendar year?
Yeah. That was from December of 14, a payroll run, to December of 15, payroll run. So it's not really fiscal year's to one to another, but it I think gives you a pretty good comparison of employment.
Thank you. Representative Gaddis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I have a couple questions. Certainly I wanted to make the statement that today, instead of $30 a barrel, we're at 26. So as we have these conversations, the price of oil continues to decline. So, you know, to let my members and let the folks listening online, I mean, we're certainly that's a challenge that we have to. So instead of 56 per barrel, we're not even at 30 today. We're at 26. That being said, I'm looking at the fiscal year 17 governor's budget, and if I'm reading this correctly, it looks like that budget is higher than the budget we passed last year that we really worked hard at trying to reduce. So I guess that's my first question on this. I'm sure you'll get through that process and explain it to us, but 5.5 is more than 5.4.
Mr. Chairman, she's absolutely right.
Any comments on that, Ms. Jill? Actually, you know, that'll be something I think Pat's in the audience here, so she'll be prepared for that on Friday. Yeah. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, David. You said it, but you ran through it too quickly for my pen, and usually the first week of finance, I'm at finance. I revert to finance 101 a little bit. And when obviously there's the agency budget, and on top of that, there's what a lot of people don't understand is statewide operations. They're not agency costs, but they're costs we have to pay. Could you run through, like, maybe again, maybe the top four or so items that I guess on page two is that light blue bar, statewide operating. That's debt service, and that's PERS, things like that. And are any of those really cuttable? I guess everything's cuttable, but in
through the chair. In a sense, it's cuttable, and you're right. It's primarily debt service and state assistance to retirement programs. That's both PERS and TERS. And once you issue debt, you've got debt service payments for the next probably 20 years. Okay, you can cut your debt service payments by tiny amounts if you refinance and get a lower interest rate. The only way you're going to make significant reductions in that debt service is to pay it off. Well, paying it off means taking cash and paying them off. We don't have the cash, so you're essentially stuck with debt service, and it becomes uncuttable. In, you know, again, yes, you can cut a little bit, but not all of it. And the same with retirement costs. We're paying for what happened in the past. There's not an employee who sees any of that money. The retirees don't see any of that money. We lost money in the stock market, and now we have to put it back in the retirement systems. You can cut retirement assistance if we get lucky and kind of reverse the January stock market results and have a lot of earnings. That will bring those state assistance payments down. But, again, there's nothing you can do to cut those unless you can make stock market moves.
Thank you, David. I appreciate that. And apart from debt service, retirement payments in that statewide operating column, which is roughly, it's over $1 billion, I guess, last year, are there any other sort of bigger items just sometimes I have a harder time with the categories. I know debt service is big. I know retirement system is big. Are there any other of the bigger ones that you can sort of paint a picture for me?
Through the chair, yes, and I think it's better to wait on that when I can go through and explain what it was in 16, what it was in 17, and I'll get there in just a couple of slides.
Thank you.
And when you're doing that, David, if you can go through with the 5.4, I'll just use that, you know, with numbers that we had yesterday or last year's budget, you know, $2 billion for formula, $2 billion non-formula, $1.2 billion for statewide, which would include the Medicaid at 650, 228 for debt service, what, 268 retirement, if you can go through those when you get there.
Okay. So, again, the big crash in 15 and in the 16 budget process, I think, was the first time that the concern that we've had at Ledge Finance, and there are other fiscal nerds that have the same concerns, that we're burning through reserves at a very rapid rate. And I think last year was the first year that that concern spread throughout the legislature and to the public. And they're now more aware of the fiscal problems that we face than they used to be, as are all legislators. So, as I said, the budget is up $65 million. It shows on here as roughly $100 million. So the bottom line here is that we're running deficits of roughly $3.5 billion a year. And those deficits are expected to drain our reserves by 2020. So we've got 3 years after this one. And that's done. Now, those reserves are not just the CBR. That's the earnings reserve account as well. So we really don't have time to look at the problem as much as you might like to look at the problem. You're going to have to probably take some action. Yeah. I don't know if representative. Okay. Well, we can spend all afternoon talking about.
Were you done, Representative?
Me?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we still have a couple other questions.
Okay.
We have Representative Munoz followed by Sadler Wilson.
Thank you, Chairman. So in the operations line from 05 to 17, there's considerable growth. How much of that is K-12 education and Medicaid, which I believe are two of the largest cost drivers in the budget?
Through the chair, they are large cost drivers. They have been. We have individual graphs on each of the agencies. I don't have the numbers back to 05 today, but you will all see those graphs in subcommittee. But you're right, the drivers are K-12 and Medicaid, and then state employee costs, including retirement costs. And as not just salaries, but benefits as well.
So, Mr. Chairman, as a follow-up, if you could give us a breakdown of what those two areas of the budget, how much of that growth accounts for the growth from 05, I would appreciate it. And also, second question, in paying down the unfunded liability, our annual payment went from $500 or $600 million, which now I think would be about $1 billion, to $250 million. And how is that reflected in this graph, if you could?
Through the chair, that's probably easier to see when we go to the fiscal summary. And right now, it's probably best to say that our state assistance cost for PERS and TERS was over $700 million a year and heading rapidly, I think, this year would have exceeded $1 billion. The legislature had a cash infusion of that $3 billion to the retirement funds along with some other reforms, and that cut those retirement assistance payments down to about $250, and this year about $215, and I think there are new valuations coming out that are going to reduce that further.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm curious why that's not reflected in the – I think it's the turquoise color on this graph, and it looks like the amount for those costs is not reflective of that change. So,
through the chair, that a good observation, and that's because beginning in FY17, under the governor's plan, permanent fund dividends are paid from the general fund, and because they appear as unrestricted general fund expenditures, they go in that turquoise bar, and that's $700 million. So that explains the growth there. And again, I was going to get to that when we get to fiscal summary, and I will talk about it a little more then.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I don't want to slow on your presentation, Dave, but a question that my constituents have asked is, you know, we've heard that we're two years away from running out of money before. What is different this time?
I think that's a matter of philosophy and how you see the need to fill the deficit. If you believe that, well, again, getting back to what I was started to say here, is that do we have a problem with expenditures rising, or is it revenues falling that's causing the deficit? And clearly, expenditures have risen rapidly, but also very clearly, revenue has fallen rapidly. Some might say it's not even worth arguing about because they're both there and it doesn't do any good. But I think that you're raising a point that's very important, because the way you see the deficit will determine how you respond to the deficit. If you see it as temporary oil market craziness, then you're justified in doing nothing, because the world is going to return to normal all by itself, and all you have to do is ride this out. But you'd think that after 3 years of $3.5 billion deficits, there would be some reaction, and you'd have to admit that we're on the edge here of calling this temporary. I think you really can't call it temporary anymore, especially given the forecast for continued $2 billion revenue stream and $5 billion budgets. So if you think it's due to spending, then you're going to say that cuts are in order. If you think that the cuts are in order, I would say, now to get to your point, Mr. Chairman, if you turn this into an inflation-adjusted graph, what do we really have? And this graph, at number four, I guess, is it adjusts for both inflation and for population growth. So you can see here that when you do that, your agency operating budgets, there might be four or five that are lower in the last 40 years. But you're not spending more. You're spending less on a real per capita basis than you have at pretty much any point in history. So you look at capital's also pretty tiny relative to past years. Statewide is up, but again, we're paying for the past there. You're stuck with those things. So that even cutting to the magic $4.8 billion mark, that's a cut of roughly $700 million. That fills 20% of the deficit. Cutting spending is simply not going to fill your deficit. Not entirely. It helps, but you cannot cut your way out of this. You've heard me say that for a couple of years. If you think that what we have is a longer-term revenue problem, I'd say now the facts are on your side. Per capita inflation-adjusted revenue is by far the lowest it's ever been. And you may say, well, does that mean we should tax citizens to replace the lost oil revenue? That would take over $5,000 per capita. And again, that's per capita, every man, woman, and child. It's not per worker. So on a per worker basis, you can triple that or even quadruple it. I don't think you can tax $20,000 from people. You may be able to, but it's probably not a workable solution. My conclusion is that the traditional ways to close deficits, which is cut spending or increase taxes, are insufficient. You can't cut your way out of a deficit. You can't tax your way out of this deficit. That even a combination would bring massive economic shocks. So I don't know if that's a kind of getting to your question, I hope, Representative Sadler. It's, but to continue this, it's...
David, yeah. Maybe a little more clarification on what Representative Sadler asked. How many years could the state sustain with the deficit of, say, a $3.5 billion deficit with the pots of money that are available for the legislature for appropriations, earnings reserve, CBR, other funds? What are the value of those different funds and then the total value of that divided by 3.5? I guess we could tell you how many years if we just worked on savings at a $3.5 billion deficit.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The when I talk about running out of reserves, the CBR has roughly $7 billion in it. So that will be gone in after 17, you use half of it, and in 18, it's gone. You then turn into the earnings reserve account, and that's about the same amount of money, and again, you can go through that in 2 years. Then I think people say, well, now you're completely out of reserves. You have to cut down to $2 billion that you've actually got in cash flow revenue. It's not exactly accurate because at that time, you wouldn't be sitting here talking about using permanent fund reserves. You would be forced to use them. Essentially, you probably wouldn't be able to pay any dividends at all. You wouldn't be able to inflation-proof at all. You would have to take that entire $50 billion fund. Of course, once you burn the reserves, you're down to $40 billion fund. And if you earn 6% on that, you've got $2.5 billion or so that you can now spend. But that puts you in an extremely dangerous situation because you can't count on $2.5 billion a year in interest. There are some years we might actually lose money on our investments, and then you would have no income other than the $2 billion or so that comes from our traditional sources. So
bottom line, if there's $7 billion in the CBR, Constitutional Budget Reserve, $7 billion in the earnings reserve, $14 billion, $3.5 billion deficit, 3 or 4 years if we took no action for any new incomes. I don't think we can go much lower on how much revenue we're making off of oil. Minimal difference between $20 and $30 and $40. But I'm just trying to say, emphasize the amount, the timeline. You know, we've heard about kicking the can down the road and things like that has to be done this year. You know, maybe it might take a little longer to get it right. You know, I don't know. And we'll see in the long run what happens. What do we got? Representative Sadler, Wilson, Guerra, Guttenberg. Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on the previous slide that you're on now where we're talking about how much, so is that the actual, so we spent $7.8 billion. We spent 7.3. I'm not talking about is that what we budgeted? Is that actually what we spent those years?
Through the chair, that is. That's no inflation adjustments. That's actual dollars.
Does that include deposits into the CBR?
No.
And a follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
So about how much right now on our reserves for the permit fund do we generate currently?
Through the chair, just to clarify, on an annual basis? Or
annual basis.
Yeah, it's just we earn, call it 6%, $3 billion. But of that $3 billion, we're currently inflation-proofing and using $1 billion for that, and we're paying dividends. Last year, they were about $1.4 billion. So of the $3 billion that may come in, we're spending $2.4 billion of it, roughly, leaving you with a surplus of $600 million in earnings, but you don't always get that surplus, and that's the danger.
follow-up.
Representative Wilson.
And I do understand that, but I agree with you that we can't continue to do $3.5 billion. I think everybody at the table would agree we can't keep those kinds of deficits, you know, on it. But I guess what I'm trying to you know, with cutting back down and using the sustainable budget that we've looked at and getting down to 4.5 or even eventually to $4 billion, you know, and having to take a little bit less out of the CBR within the next year or so by doing that, does that still not get us there? Is that what you're saying? I mean, because I don't think we could ever stay at the 5.5 that's right now. I think that has to be at least 4.5, if not lower. Closer to the $4 billion you get, the more reserves you have. So in your expert opinion, and if you were writing the budget, what should that number, you know, for the 07 be at this point to be more in line to what would be sustainable without adding in all the taxes that have been proposed?
Through the chair, I really can't say what needs to be spent. I can tell you only that the people think that the legislature is spending irresponsible. The growth has been very high and must be wasted because they don't see anything for it. That seems to be the results that Rasmussen's getting. Whether it can be at 4.5, I'd say no, it's too high if you don't do anything else, because you're now burning through your reserves at $2.5 billion a year. Yes, they last longer, but you really haven't solved the problem. A $2.5 billion deficit is absolutely unsustainable.
So one last follow-up?
It wasn't.
So on page 2, and if we look at, back to kind of looking at, you know, 05, 04, 05, where we're a little bit more, you know, within reason of where it's going, would that, in your expert opinion, be what our goal should be, is to bringing our spending back down to that level? Because I know I've received a lot of charts from different people on population growth being pretty minimal. So I'm not sure how we justify how we've gotten as far up as we are. So if we, as you know, especially in our subcommittee, start looking at what our departments did in 05, would that be a more realistic way of at least knowing what number we should be striving for?
Through the chair, that's why legislative finance has been providing these graphs to subcommittees for the last 4 years, is that it gets you to that 05, the theory being that if you need to cut back, maybe you should begin looking at unwinding some of the increases that you've had. It hasn't worked as I'd hoped it would work, and I think that's very easy to see why. Once you take inflation and population growth into account, the operating budget has not grown. It's shrinking. And it becomes an issue of what people think. They're very strongly opinionated, but I'm not absolutely certain they know the facts. And what would you expect people to tell you to do to the budget when they think the budget is growing like crazy? When, if you look at the numbers, it is not growing like crazy. We had a $7.8 billion budget in 13. It's now down to 5.5. That's a $2.3 billion budget cut in the last 4 years. That's 30%. Does the public know that? They think we're growing. Now, you can look at this and say, well, that's because we're just cutting capital. That its agency budgets really aren't. And from my perspective, that's true. But as far as the deficit's concerned, you spend a dollar on capital or you spend a dollar on operating, it does the same thing, exactly the same thing. It's a dollar more in deficit. So it doesn't matter where you cut. The problem is total spending, and that's fallen by 30%. I don't believe the public understands that. The public thinks that we need to cut more and more and more. But when you ask me where we can cut to, and I say, I don't know, it's really hard to find cuts in agency budgets. You've got capital cut back to little more than the federal required to match federal projects. Statewide, if you can't unwind it, the debt service and the retirement costs, there's not much to cut there. Where do you find the money? You know, a $700 million or a 10% cut or anything like that is going to move you down substantially lower than we've ever had before. What that means is you can't provide the services. That's your problem here, is to figure out how much less you're going to do with less spending. Because you're going to be spending less, you don't have much choice. But how do you decide which agencies spend less and what services get cut? And as you say, that's why you're going to be here all 90 days and perhaps more trying to figure this out. If it were easy, we could do it this afternoon.
And, Mr. Chair, I was just looking more of that dollar. I mean, it's our responsibility to figure out where they need to go, but more what would be a sustainable level and then go for that. And a question to, you know, why people think that. I'll tell you why they do in North Pole, because we're being taxed, you know, from property taxes. We have higher energy costs, not as high as some of the counterparts, but we've got a group that's sitting on the edge right now that if we add other things, a domino effect could even be more devastating. But on this graph, could we get a graph that would just show, Mr. Chair, that just with the population growth, not with inflation in it, just how, I mean, because inflation's kind of, I mean, I know there's some kind of mathematician who believes in that, but I think for mine it would be easier to explain how the population growth and how much operations have gone in that comparison without having in there the CPI. I just think the graph would look a lot different. I could be wrong, but I think our growth in operations has grown substantially compared to how many people that we're actually serving. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, just to give a rough answer on that, the population has approximately doubled from just under 400,000 people back here to just under 800,000 now. So you've doubled your population, and therefore, you know, you can go 2 to 1. But I can get a graph that's just population adjusted. It'd be easier for you to see. But you're right. The total adjustment for population and adjustment, as I said, population is about you're going to double things. Inflation is about $3, $3.50. So that triples things. So population is responsible for maybe two-fifths of this increase, or the flatness, so that you're right, this might be up here someplace and would be less flat. But I'll get you the graph.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I guess we're all hired to lead, even if we can't get the message that's across to the public about the budget, which is just very complex. But on page 4, if you look at the budget adjusted for inflation and population, not including the capital budget, we're somewhere below where we were in 2008, fair to say. Spending less in agency operations and statewide operations?
Mr. Chairman, yes. If you just kind of go along flat, and here's a line, there are a few years, 2003, maybe 99, maybe 4 or 5 years in the past 40 that we've been at this low.
And Mr. Chair, just a couple questions to find out whether we might be in worse shape than the bad shape you're pointing out. We always talk about it in terms of this $3.5 billion budget deficit, and it's very rough, but that really depends on what our oil price projection is. And I actually don't know what oil price projection you're going off, but are you going off an oil price projection that's much higher than what the price of oil has been the last 6 months? And is the deficit even greater than $3.5 billion possibly?
David, just to clarify whether, I think Representative Guerra mentioned your estimate on the price. So I think you're working off the Department of Revenue's estimate for oil.
It is. Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We're just using Department of Revenue figures. Those figures are for $56 oil. Oil's been under 30, but it was higher than that at the beginning of the year. So right now the average price is closer to $40. But might as well just turn to this sensitivity chart now, because I think it gets to your question about, well, is the deficit really larger than we say it is? And I believe it is. But if you look back at past years, you get used to saying, how sensitive are we to the price of oil? And here, if you take $100 oil and go up and see how much revenue we would have generated, roughly $4 billion. If that oil were at $110, you're here at roughly $5 billion. So a $10 price change gave us $1 billion. Now, here's where we are, roughly $30 oil, roughly $1 billion in revenue, and if we go to 40, you're at maybe $1.2 billion. So that because production is low and because the way the tax structure works, it really doesn't matter a whole lot whether you're at $30 oil or $40 oil or $50 oil. You don't gain much revenue when prices increase until you pass this kink that occurs here at about $80.
And just last question, Mr. Chair.
Isn't good.
And is that largely because the way the oil tax is, that 4% minimum tax is really our tax up to about $70, $80 a barrel?
Through the chair, yes, we're at the floor right now. And, you know, whether we're at the floor for the whole year, it's hard to say, but it's not completely the floor. It's just the tax rates go very low. And whether you bump the floor or just close to it, as you can see, at these prices, you just don't generate any revenue, even when you get another
$10. Representative Gutenberg, followed by Representative Edmund. David?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Guerra's question brought me to the graph, a graph I wanted to see. But, you know, the public...
What page are you on, David?
Well, 4 is good. I mean, he went to 7, you know. So I'll ask the question, and he can take us where he wants to. How's that?
Marvelous.
The public sees the price of oil drop through the floor, like, and they don't see it at the gas pump. And we have to justify that to them in our conversations with the public and what's going on. But on the other side of the equation, some people come up to me and they say they're just waiting that the budget solution will come when oil hits 100 again. And just don't panic, just figure out some short-term fix. And when it gets to 100, the bump will be back and we'll be okay and we can put some money in the bank and, you know, continue on to a gas line or something else that's happening out there. But in that graph or on the graph on page 4 or 2 where it's easy to look at, what would that bump be on one of those graphs if oil got to be $100? I mean, here you're showing it, the increases. But if you could put it on either page 4 or 2, what would the green line look like in the current oil tax regime?
Through the chair, the sensitivity chart will show you that too. We would balance the budget if oil went to $113 average in 17, given the governor's expenditures. You can also look at it this way. At $113, you're at roughly $5 billion, which, I mean, it's just different ways of saying the same thing. You're saying, what does it take to eliminate the deficit? What does it do to revenue? Well, if we had $113 oil, it would generate the $5.5 billion that we're spending. And we would eliminate the deficit. Whether you say what impact does it have on this chart, higher oil prices bring the revenue up. It would take $113 to bring the revenue curve up to this point.
Yes. So my question is, when you look at 11 and 7 over there on that chart, at comparable prices, the spikes are much higher. So if on your revenue sensitivity chart, that's just the 1 year. It's just a one-year balancing of the budget as compared with those years where the public thinks you're going to be able to put the money in the bank and stretch it out again. Is that – that's not going to happen if it gets back to 110.
Through the chair, if it got to 110, you wouldn't have any money to put in the bank. If it got to 113, you'd be even. It would take oil higher than 113 before you have any money to put in the bank. How much money you can put in the bank, again, would depend on where you went with oil. If you went up to, $120 oil, you have roughly an extra $1 billion in revenue, meaning you can put $1 billion in the bank. So how long will that last? Well, now you're talking, if that continues, I don't have a deficit. If I don't have a deficit, I have a sustainable budget. So we now can last forever as long as oil is at $120.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't.
Okay.
And because it isn't, we have large deficits, and that means we need to pull money from reserves. You can pull money from reserves. We have been pulling money from reserves, but the faster you pull money from reserves, the faster those reserves burn up, and that's a problem, is that we've got a limited reserve balance that we're spending roughly. We're burning through reserves. One-third of our reserves will be burned up this year. So you're left with only about 2 years to correct the problem, unless there's some change in expenditures, dropping them way down, or some change in revenue that puts it way up. But again, expecting expenditures to fall to $2 billion is probably not going to happen. And some people would argue that, and revenue is not going to go up to $5.5 billion either. That's your whole problem, is trying to figure out where revenue is and trying to get a budget that matches that revenue stream so that you can then say, I've got a sustainable budget.
Thank you, Dan. Representative Edgman?
David, you talked earlier about economic shocks relative to making substantial cuts to the budget. Who do we as the legislature turn to understand the ramifications of cutting something like $700 million, maybe $1 billion out of the budget, perhaps even $500 million cuts heretofore we've not ever made proportionately, as I understand. But who do we turn to understand more than just the numbers on the screen in front of us, which, you know, if you look at Alaska GDP in its totality, it's something like $57 billion, or I'm thinking of the numbers I last saw in December. But there's economic consequences to cutting the state budget, because that's a big part of the overall flow of wealth in Alaska. But who? Let's say that we decide we're going to cut $700 million. How do we better understand what that means to Alaska's economy?
Through the chair, I guess one response to that is, so who remembers the 80s?
Page 11, when he gets to page 11, that's how I kind of was able to see what $700 million is. So.
Yeah, but I think what Representative Edgman is asking is I understand the Treasury's perspective on cutting $800 million. What does it mean to the economy? And they're two different things. If you try to look at this problem from the Treasury's perspective, it's solvable, because then you don't worry about services. You don't worry about providing education. All you have to say is, just cut. It doesn't matter where you cut. We just need to get a balanced budget. But if you're looking at it from an economic perspective, or from, you know, not Treasury, but Alaska's economy, then you have to look at who loses jobs, who leaves the state, what happens to housing prices, all those sorts of things. And we typically have not done that. ICER has done work there. I know that the McDowell Group has done a lot of that at more local levels. Statewide, I think ICER, there are probably others. You can buy economic input-output models and customize them to your state. But to summarize those models, if you cut the operating budget, it has a much larger impact than if you cut capital. That's because if you look at the capital budget, the first thing that happens is, so you're building a bridge. Where'd all the steel come from? It's imported. Who made money on that steel? Someone not from here. So if you take away all the everything but labor away from those projects, and say, well, how much of the labor were Alaskans and how much were non-residents? A capital project or a capital budget has a lot lower multiplier in economic terms than the operating budget does, because the operating budget creates an immediate job or immediate money in people's pockets that they then spend. And the capital expenditures immediately leave the state and don't get re-spent. Then you have to take that a step further and say, well, fine, we saw what happened in 80 when we cut capital budget particularly hard. There's a bunch of unemployed construction workers. They say, I can't make a living here. I'm leaving. They walk away from their houses. There's a whole bunch of houses on the market that go into foreclosure, other things. The house, the market gets flooded. The prices fall. And when the empty ones fall in value, so do the full ones that we own. And it gets complicated, but it's...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to, you know, pick this apart, but in the 80s, we did have some differences. We had bank failures. We had different things going on at that time as well. So I don't think we can compare apples and apples necessarily. I do think that, you know, we have an economy problem, and we're certainly going to struggle with it, but I don't think the bank failure is part and parcel to this challenge. And I think that is a difference that happened in the 80s. Having been here during the 80s.
Through the chair, I think Representative Gaddis has a valid point there. With internet mortgages, with many changes in the banking industry, banks may not fail anymore. They tend to sell their mortgages. I think banks held their mortgages a lot more 30 years ago than they do now.
Can I just finish off?
Go ahead, Representative Edmund.
One point. I think where I was ultimately trying to go with all this is to, you know, certainly agree that we have to cut the budget. We have to reduce it. But what I really struggle with, and I see this with the criminal justice agencies, is that you cut the budget in one place, the responsibilities move to another agency, and you end up picking it up somewhere else. You cut small schools, they all move into Anchorage and Fairbanks. You got costs that are just redistributed. that type of analysis, I think, is something we're going to be undergoing so that we have a better sense of what these, you know, not only what the impacts are on the larger economy as a whole, but what the downstream impacts could be at a, on a cost basis elsewhere in the budget. I'm looking at Article 7 of the state constitution, and if we go in and make several hundred million dollars of cuts this year, we're probably going to violate our own health, education, welfare clause of the state constitution, because we're going to have to go after K through 12, we have to go with Medicaid, and we're going to have to impact the public welfare and public health, public education of the state, according to me anyway, and others may disagree with that. But so I'm putting that out there now, Mr. Co-Chair, I appreciate the latitude to have a little bit more of a wider range of discussion. I know we'll be getting more into the numbers and the details later on, but that's just for consideration. We have to know when we cut just exactly where those savings are going to be, if in fact there is savings down the road, because many times there won't be savings.
Representative Edgeman, on that, Gaddis, you know, we will have Gunnar Knapp, ICER, those folks here, those that are economists that delve specifically into the effects of the budget and the economy, because you're exactly right, you know, and the problem is, as we've seen in the 80s, our problem here as legislators now is when the jobs that are lost, you know, one of the first things that we did was go back and have ICER look at how many jobs are lost with reducing the budget. You've heard this number before, but for the members who haven't, you know, approximately 900 jobs for every $100 million in capital, 850 jobs for every $100 million in operating, ICER's numbers. So with the about $1 billion less in the economy last year that we reduced, rightfully so, I think, that's 8,000 to 10,000 jobs. Good hard-working Alaskans, and I know we're all concerned about that. And the problem is the, and you've heard me say this before and probably will hear it again, is the effects on our budget through what happens when it happens. People turn to drugs and alcohol, and it's an epidemic and statewide. And the fact that when that does happen, we will see increases in more strains in our budget, all the way from the Alaska State Troopers and Public Safety, Department of Law, courts, HES, corrections, and those budgets. We've talked about that many times in the past, and we're very aware of that. But I just want to make sure that the public sees that and is aware of that. But, you know, it's hard economic times, and the state just does not have the money, and we're going to have to make some of those decisions, and those are the facts that we're going to have to deal with. But we'll try and get Gunnar Knapp here and get a little bit more on the effects of the economy and all that. Dave's our legislative finance person and tears the governor's budget apart and presents it to us in a fashion that we can understand and allows us to try and work through that. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any more questions at this point?
Mr. Chairman,
last year's reductions.
This is just another way of showing kind of the point that the operating budget is not as out of control as the public seems to think it is. What this does is take the FY17 budget. The numbers are probably way too small to read. It doesn't matter. The issue is just look at the pattern. Here's the 17 budget, and it goes back 16, 15, 14. And what we did was highlight the past budget that's closest to the 17 budget. There are a few that have cut back only, and this is, again, inflation adjusted. So there are a few who are in the, let's see if I can increase the size of that a little bit, that are here more recent than 12. But mostly, you're in this area, 07, 08, 09. On average, we're at the FY10 level of funding. If you do that on a per capita basis, we're back to 08. Now I did something really bad. I can't seem to get this thing going. I don't know. It won't advance. It moves.
It's a larger budget.
Thanks. I don't know what you did, but it works. So, to me, the issue is, does the public know this stuff? You just had a lunch and learn, and I think most of you are here. And the poll...
You have a copy. You should have a larger copy of the fiscal summary.
Yes, one that you can maybe read. But the Rasmussen lunch and learn pretty much said, does the public know this stuff that you've cut 30% in the last 4 years, that on a real per capita adjusted basis, we're as low as we've ever been? I don't think so. Rasmussen says they're aware that we have a problem, but they still think the budget's growing at 7% a year or more. And then you turn to perhaps the more important point, which is, well, do they feel the pain? Why are they still saying, cut me, if we've had 30% budget cuts? That if they can't tell the difference, of course they're going to be asking for more cuts because it didn't hurt a bit. And I think there you have to say, a lot of those cuts were capital. And remember that we had some massive capital budgets in past years. Those projects were funded, but haven't even started yet. So that backlog of capital projects makes it so that no one even knows we've cut the budget yet. But they will know as soon as that backlog vanishes and the capital budget dries up.
We're at now about $2 billion left in that pipeline, and probably 1 to 2 years left in that, and then there's nothing left in that. That's one of the issues I think that you'll hear me talk about. Horizontal and vertical types of construction. You know, we've got federal highway funds coming in. We've got some more horizontal for road projects, but the vertical buildings, those types of things that were covered in the capital will not be there. So those different trade groups, I think, they will probably feel it the first, in my opinion, but I'm not the expert on that. But Wilson, do you have a question?
Okay, so I so completely disagree with you. I'm sorry, I just had to say that to get on my system, because regulation plays a big role in this. I mean, it's not just about what people get. I mean, we would look at the budget in a different sense of where the money's going. I think most of us know that a smaller population uses a lot of resources up compared to the majority of people. And then that's when you get back into your health and social services, somewhat into education as people get older and they don't have children. But, you know, and I know, Mr. Chairman, you've made that point when you sent it to us, to, you know, as subcommittee chairs, of looking at regulation and how much regulation costs us and how much, I mean, that's what people feel. And they just then make that connection that if you're going to regulate me in every part of my life, well, somebody's watching me. And therefore, government's too big because they're all, you know, so it's back to that right size of government. But I don't think you can break away, unless we decrease regulation, from understanding what the budget is. But I guess my question to you, Mr. Teal, would be then, is there a way for us to better understand how much of the population in Alaska is using the majority of resources? Because, and I'll give you an example. So I live in the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and the taxes I pay right now on my house is basically so I have a place to take my trash, because I don't live in a road service area. I get a little bit of a fire service area. I don't have children in school anymore, a lot of those. So when I look at those taxes, overall, I say I'm paying too much because of what I personally use on the resources. Now, I could talk to somebody else, and they're getting other services, and they see that. So isn't the state budget pretty much the same way, where we do have a smaller population utilizing a lot of the resources, and then a whole other group of people who are using little to no, none of those resources? I mean, how do you break that up? Because I think that's really where the messaging is.
Mr. Chairman, actually, former Senator Rick Halford had an interesting article on exactly that point. I don't know what paper it appeared in. I read it a couple days ago. But if you can find that, I think it's real interesting. And his point is that you may not use those services, but you do drive on the roads. You do benefit from the police. You do all this. Someone paid for you to go to school. Now you're paying for the next generation, not for yourself. And, you know, just this whole thing of how to view the services we get versus the taxes we pay. So I don't disagree with you. I think there's a huge disconnect between what people believe they're getting and what they believe they're paying for. So I agree with you there. I think what people miss are things like, oh, I just saw some costs of Medicaid expansion. The average cost per recipient on Medicaid, the expanded population, is less than $6,000. And I'm thinking, wow, do you know that every state employee pays $14,000 a year for insurance premiums? And we got, why don't we just all go on Medicaid? It's a whole lot cheaper. And the answer is because it's the older people and the infants that burn most of the money. And, you know, now you get into the philosophy. Well, some people would argue that the purpose of government is to redistribute income and to provide services to those that need it, and basically pay for that by taking money from those that have it. The right size of government depends on you personally. Not, I mean, I can't tell you what the right size of government is.
Well, Representative Wilson, I was trying to get a better understanding of your question. Were you trying to statewide, how much what do people pay statewide in different regions and for government services?
Well, I guess that's my point, Mr. Chair, is that unless we can understand who's utilizing most of the services or some or any of the services, you know, and it kind of comes back to what Representative Edgman was saying on if we decrease the budget by so much, what kind of effect does that have on the state? But you have the, I guess I'm sitting here with a reverse saying if, you know, where's the breaking point for our constituents if we start adding all this extra that they have to pay? Because, again, throughout the state, we have some areas that have, you know, cheap energy to affordable energy to not so affordable energy. And, you know, with the diversity of the state, we could do, in my opinion, more devastation as we keep adding more stress and more payments for them to give whatever the right size of government we decide in 90 days is as we can cutting because – cutting in Representative Edgman's area may have more devastation than in mine, but more taxation would have more devastation to my constituents than maybe his, just because of that diversification. So that's what I'm trying to figure out. How do we balance those types of issues as we – I think we all agree we know we don't have any money. So, you know, where are we going to end up picking up more pieces depending upon where we decide to shift the burden of what government we decide that we must fund?
If you want to try and formulate that question, we'll work together with my office, and we'll get it over to ICER and see what they can come back with on that.
Maybe we should just use the Constitution and only fund the things the Constitution says. That might make all of our lives easier.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean, you go back to what Rasmussen numbers showed, and kind of what they told me in the undercurrent was taxes are okay as long as someone else pays them. Right? You know, We understand sort of the problem here, but we really don't feel the cuts. And in 16, the operating cuts, it's too early. This is the first year of operating cuts. You wouldn't expect people to feel them yet. So I don't know. Maybe we can just kind of start over. Now I'll start with the overview of 17, okay?
Yeah, I think that's – if we can just get to – we certainly have to get through this page here, starting with the revenue end of the world. This is where you're going to see the largest differences in the columns, is in that revenue in the first column and unrestricted general funds.
Okay. So the first thing you might notice about the the fiscal summary now has 10 lines for revenue. I'm not even going to talk about that because I don't want to talk about the governor's fiscal plan today. I think we have something next week on that. But you'll notice that in FY16, revenue comes from the traditional sources, basically oil and the other things we do. Here, there's a whole bunch of new revenue lines. That's governor's fiscal plan, and we don't really need to look at it for FY17 budget because we typically look at the budget as being the expenditure plan. It's not just an expenditure plan. The budget, as submitted by the governor, and should be considered this way, is the appropriation bills, in other words, expenditures, plus his revenue bills, plus his fiscal plan. And that become, I mean, all of those three things are his budget. He can't leave taxes out of his budget because they are a part of his budget. So this is the governor's budget, not what you've done with it or what Ledge Finance thinks should happen to it. And I'm sure we'll be preparing
that budget based on if all the governor's proposed legislation for that would enact these are all passed in their current form.
Right. So that's it includes the revenue measures. It includes permanent fund replumbing and all the things that we'll talk about next week. So you saw here on the revenue, we're up from $1.6 billion to $1.8 billion, which, again, might be good news, but as you already know, that's based on $57 oil. And if the market price isn't anywhere near that, you're not going to get that revenue. But we also talked about the sensitivity chart and know that it's not that sensitive to price anyway. So at most, if you use $30 versus $57, you're about $200 million short in revenue. Now,
thank you, sir. I don't think I've ever done this, but one of the legislators had a question that is relevant. Would you mind if I ask that? Is that okay?
If they would have a question, they can pass it to the staff to me, and I'll ask a question.
Okay.
But this is the Finances Committee.
All right.
We'll try and do what we can. But.
Okay. So now turning to the fiscal summary and the expenditure side of it. You've seen this before. You have a large version of it so that you can hopefully read it better than you can read the screen. And I'm just going to walk through some of these things. First one is the agency operations, non-formula on line 14. That's typically what we consider to be the day-to-day operations. And you'll note that if you look on line 14 and then go way over to the right to the change in UGF, and you'll see that that's down $60 million. That $60 million includes the $30 million that you last year said you're taking an unallocated, and it's going to stay there next year. So that's something to consider in your subcommittees. Right now, the way agencies treated the legislative intent on that, which was that you get the money in 16, but it's going to come out in 17. They did take it out, then they put it back in, and then they took an unallocated cut at the agency level. So they did follow the intent. Now the question for you as a committee or as a subcommittee is, are you going to have them allocate those unallocated cuts in the governor's amendment process or whatever? Because in theory, you want to know where the cuts are taken and what effect those cuts are going to have, rather than simply leaving them as unallocated and letting the agencies determine what spending happens where. On the next line, line 15, K-12, you'll see that that's down $4.5 million. That may seem odd to you because if you remember that N-17 is the last of the three-year $50 increases in the BSA. $50 increase in the BSA translates to $12 million more in expenditures. So why is it down $5 million? The answer is the governor added $17 million of earnings from the public school trust. and replaced $17 million of general funds with that trust money. That's fine. There's no problem with doing it. It's as long as you know that, well, all of the earnings that have been built up over the years are now gone. The governor does apparently have a bill, which I haven't seen yet, changing the way the school trust pays out. But at the present time, that's a $600 million trust with no effective purpose. I think people believe that the school trust is supposed to be going towards K-12 education. But for every dollar that comes from the school trust, general fund is reduced a dollar. So it never supplements. It has no purpose whatsoever. We might as well eliminate the trust for all the good it does education. But so what we have is a $12 million increase due to the increase in BSA, offset by $17 million, so you're down about five. In Medicaid, on line 16, that's $32 million reduction. Most, if not all, of the Medicaid expansion savings were taken in 16. Our understanding is that this $32 million comes from reforms that are not yet identified. So they're just hoping to save $32 million on Medicaid, if you want to look at it that way. You'll figure that out in subcommittee. Representative Sadler's scribbling, I see. Now, turning to statewide, on line 23, you'll see debt service. And in 16, debt service was $206 million of UGF, jumping to $436 million for a $230 million increase in 17.
So, Mr. Teel, mm-hmm. If you assume a $3.5 billion deficit for the next future, and if PFD is paid from the earnings reserve, which it is now, how many years will it be that they can't pay the PFD if we use the CBR earning in the earnings reserve to cover the deficit? We already covered that at $14 million. And
Mr. Chairman, roughly 4 years.
Pardon?
4 years.
Mr. Chairman, isn't there a statute in place that says you can only use half of the earnings reserve to, or up to half of it for dividends?
Through the chair, the way that formula works actually is that it takes the earnings during the last 5 years and then says take 50% of that, or really 21% of it, and then half. That determines the amount of dividends that you're going to be paying in the year. But if you have a very bad year, and we've had this where we have permanent fund loses money, then you could be in a situation in which you're paying dividends, but the earning reserve is actually empty. And we almost reached the point where we could not pay dividends in, I don't think it was 2009, maybe. So that it isn't that you take half of the balance, it's that you take half of the past 5 years' earnings, which may not be there because those 5 years in earnings were paid out as inflation proofing and dividends already, and your balance is low.
President Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David, just so people have the education budget, or I have the education budget in proper perspective in terms of how much has been spent, is my recollection correct, and correct me if I'm wrong, 2 years ago when HB 278 passed, it passed, and then there was also an additional $43 million on top of it that got distributed as if it went through the BSA. That $43 million is gone, but since then we've added 2 years of $12.5 million to the BSA. So we're actually about $18 million just in those items, less than we were 2 years ago under the governor's proposals. Is that fair? Am I missing something? I'm not accounting differences in numbers of students.
Through the chair, it's really hard to say this. in a simple way, because it depends on student counts. It depends on all kinds of things. So it's not merely the total amount that goes to the K-12 formula. It's how much of it is general funds, because we can see that the school trust fund kicked in. Well, it shows we spent less for education this year. We didn't. But the numbers will show you we spent less. When you remove one-time money, when you do all these things, it messes up the comparisons. But bottom line is that we probably spend less per student this year than we did a couple of years ago. But it's pretty close. And I don't have the exact numbers there. And in fact, they're hard to put together.
Thank you.
So the rest of that story is the amount of money that the state has spent on education up to last year has continued to increase?
Yes. If you consider what the state is spending and not just the UGF portion, if you include the school trust fund and adjust for the student count and all of that. Okay, now the debt going up by $230 million may seem like a bit of a jump. That is pension obligation bonds. Most of it is. There's about $12 million of general obligation bond and maybe another $4 million in school debt reimbursement. But the bulk of this is pension obligation bonds. And you'll notice that on line 28 for retirement costs, that was $262 million in state assistance, dropping to $50 million. So it's a $213 million reduction in the retirement costs. And those two go together because in the governor's plan, he issues pension obligation bonds, deposits the proceeds in the trust fund. When you do that, the contribution rate falls, which means the state assistance falls. But we replace that with debt service. So here's a table on how that works. In FY17, we currently are projected to pay $99 million if we don't issue pension obligation bonds. That's just retirement assistance to the state and to the munis. If we do issue pension obligation bonds, the rate would fall to 22% and we would stop paying state assistance. We would have to pay the $7.2 million to issue the debt, and then the debt service payments on that are $129 million. So we would pay $37 million more if we issue bonds than if we don't. And in TERS, pretty much the same thing happens. The state assistance would drop but not vanish. We would continue to pay $50 million. You have issuing costs and the debt service. So there's another $22 million. In short, issuing pension obligation bonds costs you $60 million in FY17. So before you ask me, I'll just answer the question, why would we do this? And the answer is because they hope that they can take advantage of the spread, borrow money at 5.5%, make 8% on it, and over the life of the bonds, come out way ahead. You can do that. And we've run a bunch of scenarios, and in almost all runs, you do come out ahead after 20 years. But if you'd sold these bonds in December and watched the stock market fall by 10%, this doesn't work. It's just a question of how much risk are you willing to take and how big is the spread on whether you support pension obligation bonds or not. At this point, I can only say that they are built into the governor's budget, and probably should point out that these numbers are one possibility for debt service payments. There are hundreds of ways to structure your debt. They wouldn't necessarily be this way in 17, but there are also several other approaches that you could take that would have the same effect without issuing pension obligation bonds.
No, we'll be getting into that in depth when we cover the governor's bill on it. Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, thank you. And we covered a little bit of it, but I want to just ask just a little bit more in detail, because I see that it's not actually applied, but I do see that it's on the big sheet, that under other state funds, they have $2.5 billion. That is, but that's in 16. Is the intent that they're going to sell those obligation bonds this year? And what I'm trying to figure out is that $2.5 billion, where are they going to place the money that we receive on those bonds? Is it going to go to the permanent fund? Is the intent that we're going to just put it in a savings account? Are we going to use it over the next few years? I mean, what do we expect with that money that they raise?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, they do expect to sell bonds in FY16, and that's why you see the cost of issuing as a supplemental. When they sell the bonds, they would take the proceeds and deposit them into the PERS and TERS trust funds. And as you know, those trust funds can then be used only to pay benefits. So the money's gone and we can't get it back. Now, the next question would be, so who pays the debt service? The retirement system, we hope, right? No. The debt service is paid with UGF. By the state, it's a state bond, and we pay them, make the payments.
So, can I? Thank you. Are we? You know, we've been burned by investment in stock market with our permanent fund or with our pensions in the past. What kind of risk? I mean, what kind of risk are we talking here? And how does this? If we had sold these in December, when it's gone down 10% immediately, we'd be starting off on a long ways to climb over the 20 years. I mean, that's not the way you'd want to start off. And we could have potentially found ourselves in that situation. What is the long-term risk associated to the people that will be receiving these pensions by the pension system taking on this debt? And are we shifting that from them because they're not going to pay the debt service, and that we're going to potentially, if this were to go wrong, add another burden onto an already struggling state trying to pay for our budget?
Through the chair, if we issued pension obligation bonds, the general fund would pay a fixed debt service schedule. If you didn't make your 8% on investing these funds, you could also be stuck with going back into paying state assistance on top of the debt service. So I don't know how to talk to you about the risk other than to say, are you the kind of guy that mortgages your house because you can borrow money at 4% and then put it in the stock market? If you are, then you like pension obligation bonds. If you think that's crazy, then you may not like pension obligation bonds.
Can I, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Munoz?
On that point, I just want...
Representative
Thank
Munoz?
You, Mr. Chairman. On that point, I just wanted to answer a statement that Representative Pruitt made about being burned by the investments. I think the return on the investments have been favorable, in that the ARM board has been very successful in those investments. But the decisions on underfunding the obligation led to the unfunded liability, as well as the high costs of the Tier 1 retirement plan and early retirement. There were three or four things that happened that resulted in the large unfunded liability, but the nature of the investments and the return on the investments was not part of that, as far as I understand. It was the actuarial recommended deposit into the trust funds was lower than what we should have invested, and that led to an underfunding of our obligation. So.
And we'll be into, again, suspect a lot more depth into those discussions. And if you need further information, Representative Thompson's working on legislation, so you can work through him. On page 3, just for clarification on this, agency operations were cut over $444 million, over 9% from agency operations, the largest one-year operating in state history. But last fall, we spent another $150 million on gas line and those appropriations like that. That makes that cut look smaller on FY16. Is that correct?
It does, Mr. Chairman. I mean, you do have these one-time things, and that was the gas line took $157 million last year. I don't know whether that's going to be sufficient. You might have to add money to that in 17, but for right now, all we can say is that's included in the FY16 numbers that we're showing you, but there's no money there for 17. So that would, as you're saying, there's a $157 million reduction that the governor's figures are $157 million lower because of one-time expenditures in 16. And if we have supplemental budgets in 17, then you're going to say all these numbers I told you about were wrong because we spend a lot more in 17 than the governor's numbers are showing.
That was somewhat of an anomaly, though, where we $150 million is fairly large, and it was on a one-time thing like the gas pipeline. I just wanted to make sure we pointed that out in the graphs for accuracy.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
So on that point, and back to the other chart, so before the gas line and other things that might have been added what we finished last year, what would have been said $5.4 billion? Where did we actually end? Because when I saw the numbers, too, I know the savings, you know, was more than $600 million. How much did we have before we added the gas line and maybe some other things that have been added?
5.2.
The gas line is the big one, really, when you look at it. There may be some others, but that's by far the biggest, Mr. Chairman.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to double-check so that, you know, I thought we were closer to $5 billion when we ended last year versus 5.4. And if that were true, then actually the budget we're going to be looking at is actually $500 million higher than where we ended last year in special session.
Again, through the chair, it could be more than 500 higher because there may be supplementals in 17. In fact, we're almost certain to have additional costs. We're probably $30 to $35 million low for fire suppression in 16 and also in 17. But there's a lot we don't know. But you're right in saying that comparing 5.4 to 5.5, you're looking at the normal budget for FY16. And we're saying, we don't call anything normal. We just add the numbers up and say, this is where you were. You can say that was one time and this is an adjustment. We need to consider this. And you can maybe understand some issues if you do that. But we just say, this is what was appropriated. That's what the number we put on the chart. And if you say, well, really, it was five, so our budget this year is $500 million higher, that's an accurate way to look at it. And it may be more than 500 higher because we may have additional supplementals in 17. But we can only use the numbers we have.
And I have one other question, Mr. Chair. Maybe this is not the right time. So I keep hearing these stories that when agencies get to the end of their budget, they go on a big spending. And I got quite a few emails on this again. How is we as legislators, or do you track that, to see that once we get really close to that, you know, June 30th, that all of a sudden there seems to be a lot of expenditures? Does anybody track that? Because, I mean, I've heard it year after year, and I've never figured out a way to actually say that's true or not true.
Mr. Chairman, we could track that in the accounting system, but I would say that I think that many managers do the same thing I do. I want to make sure that my staff is paid, and I'm not going to run short on payroll, which I might do if I say all our computers are 8 years old and we need new computers, and I'm going to go out in July, the beginning of the fiscal year, and spend them, and then find out that, oops, I'm short on payroll near June. I am going to wait until June to buy those computers once I am very certain that my payroll and all my other costs are done. It's not a matter of spending spree at the end of the year. It's a matter of not wanting to spend money until you're certain that you can spend it. But I understand the myth there. I think it's a common perception that the public has.
Thank you.
But maybe a good question for to ask the department heads there or the commissioners when you're looking at their budgets.
I have. They denied, but I have asked.
Yeah. Probably for the same reasons that I.
Thank you. I don't think we'll ever know.
You know, I skipped this. It's just a minor point, but this shows you in 17 the individual agencies. It's number 8 in yours, I think. And it just shows that virtually every agency is taking a reduction. There's a small increase in revenue and in natural resources. That's AKLNG money. And an increase in military and veterans affairs. That's that expansion of the rural presence of, it's not National Guard, but it's, you know, Scout, yeah. And there's numbers that, and there's percentages, but they really show the same thing. So back to the fiscal summary itself. We were looking at the debt service. Now you look at fund capitalization, and you see that on line 25, oil and gas production tax credits, $500 million last year, $73 million this year. Remember that we started out 16 with $700 million in expected expenditures. The governor vetoed $200 million. And in 17, the projections were credits claiming about $625 million. If you add the $200 million that we didn't pay last year that are going to roll forward, you could argue that, well, we've got $825 million of credits that we expect to pay. The governor's budget pays for 73 million of them. So back to Representative Wilson's point, is this really a $5.5 billion budget if we have to pay another 800 or 700 million in oil and gas tax credits that don't appear here? So, and yes, it would be if you don't do something that the governor has submitted a bill for, which changes the tax credits and which takes $1.2 billion from the CBR to pay some of those credits. But they're still there. They still cost money in 17. They come from the CBR instead of the UGF. But they are expenses and do understate the amount of state money that's being spent. And I don't care. CBR and UGF are the same to me. They're classified differently. When you spend CBR, it's classified as other, not as UGF. So just to get to your point, that there's lots buried in the budget that may not be visible right on the surface. The next line is permanent fund dividends. That shows us a zero in 16 and $700 million in 17. Again, that's due to the replumbing, where in 16, $1.4 billion in permanent fund dividends went out the door. But we classified them as coming from the earnings reserve account, which is part of the permanent fund, and they don't show up as general fund expenditures. Now, under the governor's plan, 50% of royalties go to dividends. Well, royalties are unrestricted general funds. So we look at it as dividends are paid from the general fund now. I don't think there's any question that they will continue to be called permanent fund dividends. No one's going to try calling them royalty dividends, although that's what they really would be. But the point is that, and I think it's a great thing, because I look at dividend checks as being, it's just a check from the government. It doesn't matter whether it comes from permanent fund earnings or the general fund. And the governor's replumbing makes it very clear that permanent fund dividends compete with K-12 and other general fund expenditures. So I think it may change your view of dividends and may change the public's view of dividends. And, of course, that $700 million shows as revenue because it comes in, and we'll talk about that next week, all the replumbing that's done.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Edwin.
Now, speaking of replumbing, isn't it cheaper to spend money out of the CBR because the CBR is invested in long-term investment vehicles versus digging into the permanent fund earnings reserve and having to spend out of a fund that's got, what, a 7-8% ROI target?
Mr. Chairman, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, the CBR, is no longer invested in long-term because the Department of Revenue has instructions laid out that if there can be a call on those funds, which right now there certainly could be used, then they cannot be invested long-term. So we're really not earning as much as we could be on the CBR simply because they have to be ready to give us the cash.
And if I might, just as a follow-up then, but in order to go into to use permanent fund earnings reserve, we are sort of extricating or liquidating investment vehicles, the equities, whatever it's involved in. But with CBR, we're not. So you start looking at the opportunity costs of not reaching into the permanent fund versus just taking the money out of the CBR. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Well, and again, the fiscal summary reflects the governor's plan. The governor's plan takes the CBR away and puts the money in the ERA. So that sort of addresses your issue of the difference in earnings, because there will be no CBR under the governor's plan. Well, I shouldn't say that, because the CBR gets settlements right now, and that might be somewhere between $120 and $150 million a year from disputes with oil companies over taxes. So that there will be a continued flow into the CBR, so the balance never really goes to zero. But his plan is to take the balance, existing balance, and put it into the earnings reserve account.
And there's more questions, but I'll save those till later.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the questions about the governor's plan probably should wait until next week, given the clock.
Dive in. Fiscal summary.
So what's left is capital. Capital's up from $118 million to $195 million, $75 million. And so your total authorization goes up to 5.4. Your net increase of about $65 million, and that's on right below line 66, that's on line 41. Then you see a bit of complication, because on line 42 we show a 16 deficit of $3.8 billion, roughly. That's in the first column on FY16. And that revenue covers a little less than 30% of the expenditures in that year. Now, if you drop to line 44, what we tried to do is anticipate your questions that, well, what if we don't do the governor's plan? What's our deficit going to be if we just do business as usual? We tried to adjust as best we could for that and say the dividend then would be about $3.5 billion, as shown on line 44, and we'd cover about a third of our expenditures with the revenue. So you also see on line 42 that under the governor's plan, the deficit falls to $440 million. So it's a substantial reduction, and what they're aiming for is eliminating the deficit. That doesn't happen in 17, but the plan is to reduce it in a couple of years. And if the numbers in the model are correct, that seems reasonable to us, because we know that dividends will fall by a couple hundred million next year, because if we do the 50% of royalties and don't prop it up to $1,000, it will fall to about $700 a piece and cost about $500 million. We also know that there are a number of things that aren't covered here. The income tax, for instance, in 17, it's in effect for half a year. So that's another $100 million in revenue that comes in 18. So the deficit should decline and actually vanish if things work out well. Now, you might ask why this seems to be the wrong direction. And here, I think you can look at this diagram, which you were looking at earlier, Mr. Chairman. And this shows the FY17 request sort of in declining order of expenditures. Many ways to look at this chart. One is that we've got $1.8 billion in revenue, according to the $56 oil, maybe less than that, but that's coincidentally about the same $1.8 billion that every agency or every purpose up through K-12 statewide and HNSS make. You could twist this and say, well, we spend $1.3 billion on statewide stuff. That's retirement, assistance, debt service, and in 17, permanent fund dividends. And the capital budget's another two. So there's $1.5 billion of our $1.8 billion gone. So if you're going to balance the budget, you have $300 million to spend on education, Medicaid, and every other agency. There are a number of other ways you can state this, but every one of them comes out, we don't have enough money to pay for what we want to do. The simple way to look at this, I guess, is that the cuts are really difficult to identify. It's one thing to say, let's cut 10% or $700 million, but when you look at this and say, well, we can't cut that, capital, and the statewide is all in the past, we can't do that. K-12, how much can we cut from that before we end up in court? Medicaid is an entitlement program. We can cut, but how much? And pretty soon you say, a $700, $500 million reduction, you're really looking at something like 20% reductions to the other agencies. But you can look at this. I think it's an interesting chart. It just shows you how hard it is to even begin to balance the budget through reducing the budget because those reductions are really hard to find. And as the Rasmussen Lunch and Learn said, people want cuts, but they also like their services. And that's a tough one. When you make cuts, the services are going to be reduced as well. Things to consider here. We've talked about the oil price and how it may affect things. And, you know, $200 million, you can say that's a lot or a little. It's margin of error in forecasting. We don't know what prices are going to be. We know that fire suppression, I already mentioned, is a missing cost here. There's revenue sharing programs. You'll notice online, I guess it's line 32 of the fiscal summary, it doesn't really matter. There's a supplemental there for revenue sharing, $35 million. That would bring the revenue sharing fund up to $150 million because the governor wants to distribute $50 million to communities in 17, and that's the number required to do it. The governor's plan also says he'd like to get to $60 million distribution. If that's going to happen in 18, then you need another $80 million deposit in FY17. If you don't make that $80 million deposit, then revenue sharing falls to $33 million in 18. So the way I look at it is, if your plan is to go to 80, Governor, then, or to $60 million distributions, then you really should put the $80 million in this budget. But, you know, he chose not to. The AKLNG, I don't know if we're going to need more money for that or not. If we looked at those expenditures, the governor's deficit would jump to something a little over $600 million from the $400-something that it is now. That's a big deficit, but it's a whole lot smaller than the $3.9 billion that you'd be at if you do the business-as-usual scenario. So we're a little stuck at this point. We have the governor's budget as submitted on December 15th, but the revenue bills just came out, and when we were putting the overview together, we didn't have them or you know, they're an independent decision. You can do the revenue bills or not. But the Permanent Fund Protection Act has been redrafted, and until today or yesterday, we didn't have a copy of that. So we're not sure right now whether we're portraying the governor's budget accurately. We think we are. We're doing the best we could. And, of course, we don't know what the legislature is going to do with it. You can continue business as usual. If you do that, you're covering only about a third of your expenditures and burning reserves at a rapid rate. You're out of reserves in 3 years. You can cut and bring that ratio up a little bit, but it's not going to extend your reserves more than a year. Or you can adopt the governor's plan or some variation of it. And when I say governor's plan, I really do mean any of these plans. You've got a GCI plan and a Rasmussen plan and a, you know, the DOR model and the ICER model, Scott Goldsmith's model. They're all the same conceptually. They all look at here's expenditures, here's revenue, and what do we do with the permanent fund earnings? There's some tweaks about inflation proofing and how much or if it happens at all. You know, our royalties 50% of, or our dividends 50% of royalties or 75%. Those are just model tweaks. Conceptually, they're about the same. They all have to rely on permanent fund earnings to fill the deficit. And the governor's plan takes where we are now and bumps that revenue curve up to here. There are other plans that could do the same thing, but the governor's plan covers about 90% of expenditures, uses, or another way to put that is it uses less than 4% of your reserve balance, meaning that under the governor's plan, your reserves can last 25 years or more. Essentially, you're sustainable at that level. So at least there's some hope for a sustainable future because the deficits will be small enough that just a little higher oil, a little more tax, or a little lower expenditures, and you'll be at a balanced budget. So, you know, I know you've got a lot of work ahead of you, and time's getting short today, and I'm pretty much wrapped up here, but I do want to say that my staff and I are here to assist you on anything we can. You got a lot of work to do.
Thank you. Thank you, David, and your staff. And I know that you spend a tremendous amount of time and quite a few hours working through this. And I know that we spent a lot of late nights together with that. Representative Garrett, do you have something to think
about? Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'll just have to go back to a lot of these slides because most of them were swallowed up by Representative Guttenberg's tie and blend straight into there. So maybe you can coordinate with him next time. I've only been told this. I haven't done the analysis at all, and I'm just going to ask you. I know the governor tried to do his plan in a way that didn't require a constitutional amendment, and it's got a lot of parts to it. But the way it's written, with money remaining at the end of the year in this new oil credit fund and money remaining at the end of the year after appropriations in the sovereign wealth fund, does that end up getting swept into the CBR and require possibly a three-quarter vote every year to get the money back into the sovereign wealth fund and into the oil tax credit fund? Is that a possible unintended consequence?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, under the governor's plan, and this is an attorney general opinion, the earnings reserve account would not be swept into the CBR, and there would be no more CBR votes in the future. I disagree strongly with that. I believe that the ERA, earnings reserve account, the court said is unsweepable because it's part of the permanent fund. And it by constitution, the earnings go into the general fund. It's only a statute that does this. And I think the plan is unworkable as written because it lacks a sweep and lacks a supermajority vote. But that's something that I think we'll examine in depth next week or in the following weeks. It's to go into the plan pretty much requires a whiteboard and drawing circles and arrows, and you know it's a complicated process that if you're concerned about the CBR vote, it's a real simple solution to repeal the statute that says the ERA is not part of the permanent fund, and we're going to follow the Constitution and say that those earnings are part of the general fund.
And we need to wrap up, and that issue alone has been a topic of many hours of discussion and already with the departments and the administration and our office on where we're at on that. Tomorrow, on Thursday, January 21, thank you, David, and your staff. We have an update on interim results-based budgeting work with Craig Holt, Director of Outlook Associates. What they did is they took Department of Transportation Public Facilities budget, implemented the results-based budget into that, similar to what they did working with the Health and Social Services several years ago, in an effort to try and make it so that these budgets are easier for us to understand and also look at the departments as the departments categorizing their priorities and bringing them to us. So it's an easier way, I think, not just for us but the public to look at the budget and understand it and see those budgets. So we will have that presentation tomorrow, and then a follow-up, a workshop with legislators on Saturday on that. So with that, thank you, members. We'll adjourn for the day.